The following message by Dr. Howard Kleinbell was delivered on Thursday afternoon, April 15, 1982, at 3 o'clock for the William and Vi Cessna Lectureship in Pastoral Counseling held in the Broadhurst Auditorium Gymnasium. The subject of this message is Using Losses, Crises, and Grief as Growth Opportunities. From the general theme, Biblical Resources for a Growth Hope Approach to the Ministry of Caring and Counseling. This message was recorded through the facilities of Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky, and is now made available to you through the seminary's tape library. Additional copies may be ordered by contacting the tape library and giving complete identification of this message. This is tape number 82AA2B. Since ownership privileges must be observed, the seminary is requesting that you take personal responsibility to see that messages are not transcribed into manuscript form or other copies duplicated without specific written permission from Asbury Theological Seminary.
Encephalitis, and she was reduced to infancy. And for a period of about 2 years, she began to come back after a long coma and was able to put a sentence together and read and write, do some addition, simple addition. And I thought she would be with us for a long time. Physically, she's in good condition, but in the last 9 months, she's begun a trajectory downward in her health mentally. And so where I am now is that I am at the point where I realize that while I've had a great deal of help from my congregation and people have been very loving and supportive, that I now realize that I am going to have to place her in an institution.
It really feels heavy as you talk about it, Paul. I'm really sorry. Yeah. Both the loss that you feel of your wife and her mental condition, also having institutionalized her, instead of one of those grim realities that you, very hard thing to do, right? I think that where I'm resonating inside myself is the decision we had to make when my mother became psychotic, acutely paranoid before she died, 18 months of having to put her in a nursing home. Ah, awful. Not wanting to do it, and yet realizing we were powerless to do anything else. And it's a deep, deep experience. And it's like a multiple loss I'm hearing, that you've had both progressive loss of the companionship of your wife and all that, plus the loss now of having to do something that you don't like, and yet there's no option, if I hear you. Is that right? Uh-huh.
I think that two things that are happening to me now are helpful to me. The first is that I'm finding being alone, because she's been hospitalized for such a long period of time, has been less painful than it used to be. And that has been helpful. One of the things that has been a great help to me has been I've kept a diary from the day this began, and have written down everything that's happened and my reactions to it. And each night before I go to bed, I write to her in my diary and explain what we've done. And she is now at the place where she seems to be regressing back into a world of hallucination and delusion, which is of such powerful nature that it almost is as though I am intruding upon her privacy when I try to talk with her. And in fact, on occasions I have said, "Would you really rather that I not try to talk with you anymore?" And she'll pat me on the hand and acknowledge that that's really what it is. She's not able to really talk much anymore. And my trying to bring her into my world has been painful for her. So I sense that.
It seems, I'm sensing it's very painful to you, Paul, that in her withdrawal into her own, in her dyingness, apparently, she's doing what a lot of people do in that stage, which is to withdraw in a way that's extremely painful to the loved ones around. And it's sort of like, I just want to say how good it sounds when you talked about keeping a diary, you call it, yeah? Yeah, I keep a journal regularly. It's a great way to survive and to learn from what you're experiencing as well as, right? I think that's really one of the most important methods that has been helpful to me during the most stressful 3 years of my life. The last 3 years has been to keep a journal, you know, and to really talk to the journal, so to speak, like Elaine, you were talking to your mother, you know, and just write it down there. Talk back, even. That's the other side of it, right? Yeah. Yeah. Have you discovered that your wife's tragedy has made any difference in your ministry, Paul?
Yes, I'm sure it has in many ways. I went to Cincinnati a short time ago thinking that with some plans to build a new house and a lot of retirement plans eventually and all those kind of things, which have absolutely no meaning, of course, anymore. Other things are coming to the fore. I have found, yes, that it has put a totally new dimension to my ministry. I think it's an incredible price to pay for that. I would like to have believed that somehow I could have learned to do that without. But in any event, that is the truth. Yes, it has been helpful to me. Find myself moving backwards to some other things over my lifetime that I was very close to at one point in time, but had kind of let go over the years, and I find myself returning to some of those things with a great deal of satisfaction.
Discovering that you can live more comfortably with your aloneness feels like growth to me. I just want to say that you don't have to lean. You know, you can really, you have resources that you're drawing on. Yeah, that's good, right? Thank you. Emery?
My grief is not in that I'm grieving persons that have died in my life, but these are persons or a relationship that has not yet been. I'm divorced. I've been divorced for 8 years. And then at that point, some feelings that I have had of rejection culminated. And since that time, each time I have felt a rejection in a relationship, I've experienced that grief over and over, and it's continued on for those 8 years. But when I became a Christian, Christ started turning those things outward and stopped turning them in where it would destroy me, and I began to learn from those things. It's still very tender around that, but I'm able to see other people's hurts. I'm still grieving to some extent because there's no relationship there. But I can accept that. And like I see so many lonely people, and it is rampant. And I can reach out to those people.
Sherry, it seems what I'm really sensing is that your Christian experience has been deeply meaningful to you. Yeah, right? It feels like there's a lot of pain. Is the pain, as you experience it, from the divorce and whatever that meant to you, or from the subsequent rejections and breaking off a relationship?
The subsequent breaking off of the relationships. Yes. And it's not so much as unresolved, but it's like a painful memory. You know, it's not crippling me in any way.
In fact, if I heard you, you said that it allowed you to reach out to people in a different kind of way, which is the growth. Yeah, right. Yeah, this is just a question that's going through my mind, but I wonder, have you ever really had an opportunity to ventilate the anger that came from that sense of rejection? Did you ever have a chance to really ventilate that and pour it out and work it through?
Yes, as a matter of fact, this last January I went to India. And I was placed in a situation where I had nothing to do but face my feelings. And God used that time to cleanse all that out. And I expressed anger to God. I shook my fist at him every day for 3 weeks. And I screamed at him. Spiritually, I didn't scream physically, but inside I screamed at him. And blamed him for all the problems. And he just patiently waited.
You found out he's strong enough to take that, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it feels good.
I feel a sense of inadequacy in my guilt. I feel guilty about being here even. Because my guilt isn't, I guess on a scale of 1 to 100, maybe as tragic as what these other people have experienced. But maybe it is also, I'm not sure. Last year I resigned a position as a professor in a Bible college and made a change to becoming a counselor. And there's unresolved feelings of loss from what I was to what I am, although I feel good about what I am and what I am becoming. At the time that I made the transition, it wasn't the most pleasant of situations. There had been a change in administration, and I became out of favor with the new president of the college. My department head was to evaluate me and turn in a recommendation whether I was to stay at the college or not. And he and I had a good working relationship, I thought. And I worked with him and had him invited him into the classroom and all kinds of things, and we worked together on evaluations. And then at the end, what I thought would be a good report came back negative. That's what the new president wanted. And I felt like Judas had kissed me.
You really felt betrayed.
I felt betrayed. Yeah. And I felt like I had an affinity toward counseling for a long time, so I just decided to get out of that. I kind of burned out on it. And at the same time, I didn't have anybody to talk to. If I talked to my wife about it, she became very angry and hostile, and I had to be more on a positive thing. I had to say, this is a positive change in my life. I had to say that this is what I want to do, and I'm happy for the change, and I had nobody to talk to about it, so it's something I had to keep inside of myself. And when I would come down to Lexington to plan for the counseling change, everybody said, "We're glad you're coming." You know, it was a positive thing, and I just felt.
But you kind of put a surface over the anger.
Yeah, and I never really had been able to break through that. The one time, this friend of mine and I played handball together, right after the decision had come in, and I played handball hard, and. I felt like I really did do some ventilating of anger through the game of handball with him. He's better than I am. He beat me, and I didn't help things any. But I still, there's still unresolved anger. And on his part, he felt guilty about what he had done. So any anger toward him, he said I was a prince the way I took it, you know, after he made the decision that I was going to leave. So how do you get angry at a man who feels guilty about what he's done, even though he's done you wrong? Right.
I have a suggestion. I don't know if it'll be useful, Emery, but one way that I'm the sort of person who was raised in a good Methodist family where I was taught that good little boys don't get angry. You know, so I learned to swallow a lot of that stuff. One thing that helps me is to go out in my garage, and this may not work for you, but I get a big cardboard box. You know, when I'm angry at somebody I can't express it to directly, and I kick the whatever out of the box. You know what I mean? And I yell. It's good to do it when the neighbors aren't around. But, you know, it's amazing. It's like your big muscles don't lie. And my mind says, well, I'm just feeling depressed. But whenever I get depressed, it's usually because I'm turning the anger on me. And you felt a little depressed when we started the group day. I don't know if you're feeling depressed or not. But I just wonder if it worked with handball, was it? It might work with more handball, or another way to do it is to get a tennis racket and pound the daylights out of a bed, you know, and do it when you can shout and yell and really get it out, because that is so healing. I just feel that you must have a lot of rage. I would if I had been betrayed by the person I was trusting to write me a favorable recommendation, right?
I feel betrayed.
Yeah, right.
Rage.
And it seems to me that rage is not hurting that person, it's hurting Emery. That's why I'd like to have you really work at, and you know, talking it out with a good therapist has helped me, but it's equally important to, you know, to really let the big muscles go. And the nice thing about a box is it doesn't kick back, you know. How does that sound?
I'd rather have him around than the box.
Yeah, right. Well, if that's feasible, but Yeah. Yeah, I just hope that you can get that anger out, because that really would be a great... The energy that I experienced when I finally pulled the plug on the anger about my sister's death, for example, it was really a flow of energy and creativity that I didn't know was in there. Just because it's like the anger I didn't face was like a dam in the inner flow of my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it bothers me that I don't allow myself to express that as like I should. Like, it would be hard for me to go out and kick the box or beat the bed because of the background that I have. And I think that I'll consider that. You know, that might be something I need to do to get it out.
Would it help if I was your doctor and I made this a prescription? Your prescription is to go home and kick the hell out of a box, okay?
Okay.
Okay. I'd like to have you drop me a card and tell me what happens when you do it, okay? Would you be willing? Okay. You'll probably feel guilty, I suspect, from what you said. You know, you might feel, what I get when I really let it hang out is the immediate response is, gee, I shouldn't have said that. I'm a bad person, you know. It's the old programming. But I think that to go beyond the guilt, to recognize that it's not bad, it's a good thing, to get it out so it doesn't eat away at one's insides. So, yeah. Good luck.
Thank you.
I appreciate your sharing this. You look more alive than you did when you started.
I feel more alive. Before this session, I went out and listed the pressures that I have on me on a pad of paper just to moving here, and you talk about the scale that you had on the board.
You went off the top?
I went off the top, right. And then I went down and did an exercise on what I can take care of each of those tensions that I have. So I feel some better by doing that, but I still have the tension of the situation left.
I think if any of us are experiencing just an awful lot of pressure from multiple causes and stresses and losses, that this is exactly the time to really get... do you have a support group, Emery, of people you can really let down your hair with or anything?
I have a small support group I can work with, yes.
Can you be honest with
me? Yes.
That's good. I mean, I think that kicking boxes is one thing. It sort of releases the pressure, in important ways temporarily. But I find that unless my men's group, I'm in a men's support group. We were all married to liberated women, did it out of self-defense initially. But eventually I discovered I could trust my brothers. And just by sheer coincidence, or maybe the grace of God, we happened to be together the night before my mother died. And I wept with my brothers. And I could never weep with a man. I could weep with a woman, my wife, for example. But never a man. It was weak, you know. And just letting my brothers in my support group, letting me be honest with them about how the awful feelings I was having about her psychosis and the miserable place she was living and so forth, tremendously helpful. So I'd like to encourage you to take a crack at that.
I should say that I have a group that could become a support group in this way. And if they're willing to do that, it would be helpful for me. Mm-hmm. I'm being supervised in a dual supervision, and there are times that I would like to express some anger and frustration, but it has to be mainly supervision of what I'm doing. And so I may see if I can work out something with them where there could be a support group for working out.
Could your group go off for a retreat and just work on everybody's grief and growth problems? That would be a possibility. You know, some groups are doing that.
Possibility.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think having a support group is absolutely... ministry can be a very lonely business. You know, particularly if we have pedestalitis, if we're sitting on some pedestal that the congregation tends to put us on, we can't be human, we can't be honest, particularly about feelings like the ones we're experiencing and talking about here, and that can be a bummer. So I think to find our own support group, and if this group won't do it, I hope you'll find another one. My hope for you is that you'll create one, of people that can be a support for each other in this honesty way. Right? Yeah, what you mean, the business of getting rid of the anger block, the dam, is that there's so much, as I said, so much energy and creativity dammed up behind that. And letting that out is really good.
There's one thing that there has just been a fatigue. When I first came down with the change of vocations, I was really excited about it. But I guess I've gotten to a place where you talked about dammed up energy, and there's really a fatigue that's set in just recently. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one reason I asked to join this group, because I want to begin working on that, and I really haven't allowed myself to work on it.
Yeah. I think at least 50% of most burnout is unfaced grief and unresolved grief work. And I think, you know, just the business of carrying around a pack on one's back psychologically is exhausting, isn't it, after a while? Unfaced anger, whatever it is, guilt. It's really a bummer. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, in regard to resolving grief, I had a friend who would just come to the house for about 3 months after my mother died, and I did an awful lot of crying in those 3 months, and that was really helpful. And she just sat and would let me cry, and it was really good.
That's great. Yeah. Appreciate you sharing that, Elaine. The grief that I got in touch with two feelings when I went inside myself. One was being back in the Middle West here. I really realized that there are things in me that are still going on with reference to my mother's and my father's death. I had some feelings about that. The other is anticipatory grief about my next birthday. I'm going to be 60 in June. And I realized, my God, I can't be 60. That's impossible. Yet I am, you know. And even though the life is better than it's ever been in some ways, I'm anticipating being over the hill, feeling over the hill. You know, I really don't. You know, I don't feel 60 at all. And yet, because my image of 60 is that people who are 60 are over the hill. I'm just recognizing that I wasn't even in touch with the full force of that grief until I closed my eyes and did what I was asking you to do. So it was helpful to realize that I've got some work to do around that little old birthday that's coming up. So I got in touch with both those things there, and it's good to have a chance to share that. Did any of you, I just want to ask a question about, as you think about your experience, any of you who haven't mentioned it, thought about the loss you've had in terms of anything it's given you, anything that has been even a little bit helpful or constructive in your relationships or anything else? That I'm not trying to paint over something that really is still unfinished for you, but is there anything that you can share that with us as a group that where this has been useful or helpful to you?
From just being able to accept my situation, whatever it is, I have a comfort in that. And I don't feel self-conscious about sharing it anymore. I don't feel self-conscious about expressing love for other people, afraid that they might not love me back. It doesn't so much depend on other people's response to me anymore.
Feels like real growth. Right? Yeah, right. Is there anything that you've thought about in connection with your losses you need to do? Emery and I have conversed here about that. Or anything you'd like to say to anybody else in the group? Any response you had when he or she was talking? Anything that feels unfinished in terms of what you'd like to say to each other? You've really been through some heavy things.
To Sherry, it seemed like your conversion was a big thing in your life, and that was where somebody did accept you, totally accept you. And I think that's a big thing for me, too, is that even though I've been a Christian for years, to know that God accepts me, not for being a professor or being a counselor or whatever, just He accepts me. And that's something that I don't have to earn God's love. He loves me. And it's really a good feeling. There's one other aspect of grief. When I came back, we came back to Lexington, which was my wife's home, and her parents both died this winter. And I had to preach both funerals of my mother-in-law and my father-in-law. And I had to support my wife and the entire family at that time. And I love my mother-in-law and father-in-law very much. They meant very much to me, but I didn't allow myself to express grief the way I should have at that time. So, and it's really hard for me to talk to my wife and family about it again, although I think it would be good, like JR is doing, to talk about it, because there's grief I have that I need to share, and my wife needs to share too.
Yeah, my hunch is that if you were willing to risk that openness with them, that you might help them deal with whatever is left there, and there. You know, it's one of the professional hazards of being a clergy person is that we're busy helping other people with their grief, and it's awfully hard to deal with our own simultaneously. You know, and I'd just like to say I think it's very important for you to deal with that. If you've had a double loss of two significant people like your wife's parents in 1 year, you've got a heavy load from that one. You know that. Is probably also part of your depression, isn't it, really?
For me, something else was almost in challenging something you said this morning. Basically, the feeling that I had a loss of control was physical control. But to me, my faith really supported everything that I was feeling, in that I never felt anything of my faith ripped out from under my feet, like the rug you talked about being ripped out. And what I really saw around me was everybody else who came in contact with me having that problem, my father the worst, seeing no hope in anything that was going on in the situation at all. And to me, the fact of my faith supported the whole thing that we were going through, and that I was able to share that then, and am still sharing with other people, made a big difference. The fact that I knew what I believed in, and I knew what I believed in with respect to my daughter, and I couldn't believe how many people around me didn't have that faith, or they had voiced that faith before, but yeah, for some reason they were unable to share anything in that respect.
I'm not in any sense questioning what you just said, Jerry. I just want to say my experience is somewhat different. What I found was, I got converted various times in my early life, and those were very meaningful experiences to me. What I found was that the feeling about God's love, which was there, it was sort of like, as a minister and as a one who had been converted, that I had to have it together. And what it did was delay, in one sense, my dealing with my rage or my guilt. Because, I really couldn't admit to myself. I had to go around reassuring other people, and I was so busy doing that that the spiritual dimension of my experience was a two-sided thing, you see. It was supportive of me, as yours was. But it also, I think, because I tried prematurely to, really make faith work, unquote, rather than deal with the very earthy, gutsy feelings I had, that it blocked some of those feelings. I don't know if anybody else has had that experience, but it's sort of it's easy to use one's faith that way.
I can identify with that a lot, because I think you said your faith supported you, but my faith blocked me from the rage that I should have. My faith said to me that I should be strong, I should stand up when I wanted to cry at my father-in-law's funeral, my mother-in-law's funeral. And so really there's some rage toward God, I guess. Why do you put me in a position where I can't express myself the way I want to express myself? And for me, the love of God is very, very sustaining, but the faith almost has to be shown in the way I act, and it was a deterrent, it still is. It's something I've got to work through, where I can feel anger toward Him, I guess, for blocking that.
I think I have to say then, for me, that's where it would be different, because I never really felt that I was blocked from anything, especially from expressing emotions that I had. And I didn't feel like in expressing those that I was showing any doubt or questioning of faith. And so it was easy for me in that respect. Maybe that's where a difference lies.
I think people expected you to show grief, and it was a proper thing to do. But in both of my cases, people expected me to be strong. This is a good vocational change, and you need to be strong for your family. So I wasn't allowed. My faith was supposed to support me and make me strong when I wanted to be weak.
Yeah, it helped you put the lid on not dealing with those feelings, if I hear you. I think, that your experience, JR, and some of the rest of us, they're different kinds of experiences, and one of the values of a group like that is to discover both what we share and have in common in our experience and also what's unique to each of us, and to respect that differentness. Very important. Is there anything? Yes?
Just to say that I want to affirm what I hear you saying about small group dynamics. We had a small group started after this happened to me. I gathered around me some people who had been traumatized by life, divorcees, alcoholic, people who had serious illnesses and so forth, and some failures in business and so forth. And this system was very supportive of me, and I of them, of course, and in the process we built some tremendous ties that have continued to spread out through the congregation, and one of our good associates, Steve Hord, who's here today, has taken on the responsibility of continuing that.
You're an ongoing group.
Yes. Yeah. It's a great place to funnel people who are in trauma of one kind or another.
That's a very important ministry. That sounds great, yeah. I think in a way you became the church for those people, the care, community of care, and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, that the way that the Holy Spirit can work in a group like this, you know, without even talking religious language often, but just the awareness of the presence of the... Have you experienced anything of healing just in the short time we've been together? Anything that's been useful? Should we do a go-around and just find out how people feel right now, Sherry?
I've had more of an affirmation of healing last Tuesday night. I think the last vestige of that grief or the fear of being alone left me. It was a particular time when a friend of mine prayed for me, and that left me. But this has been an affirmation because I've been able to talk about it.
I think I could share mostly with Emery in that he's coming at it from a different aspect of what his faith really did in his situation. That helps some in understanding some of the sharing. I share in a group known as the Compassionate Friends, which is bereaved parents. And for many of them, it's a similar kind of thing. They've had their faith in that same perspective and said that they felt that they weren't able or weren't expected to show grief. And, well, other feelings that they get into it would take a whole lot longer to go through.
I guess I've just found it meaningful or interesting that even though we've all had different things to share in terms of grief, that I sense the same spirit or the same emotion present in all of us and the same kind of bond.
I feel like I've just started working on something I've delayed for a long time, and I feel good about the beginning.
I feel greatly relieved, much better than I did when I sat down here. And I am past the worst part of what's having to happen. The last part is something that I am going to handle. I'm a survivor, the grace of God, and it's going to happen. But I greatly appreciate your help.
You're having an opportunity to do some of your grief work in advance in stages. That's right. Yeah, I'm just aware of another thing, which is that I feel closer to each of you. A lot closer than I did 30 minutes ago. It's sort of like, you know, I feel the ties just from the simple act of sharing with each other. And it's almost like each of you, in your own way, gave all of us a gift by what you shared, you know. How did you feel about my just mentioning what I was experiencing in my grief? Was that okay?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, one of the things that is important for me, I don't always practice it, is not to ask other people in a group to do what I'm not willing to do myself. So I wanted to get in touch with that. It's very helpful to me to simply say it, what I was feeling in here, you know, in here. I did that, yeah.
I have a question. Since you lead in groups like this a lot, and you share probably some of the same experiences, do you have the same degree of emotion or grief after you've done this? Like some of the things you shared today, you probably would share in another grief group, and you shared them like in books and other things like that. Does the grief go down as you share them over and over again, or is it still painful?
Yeah, I think that what I was saying about what I experienced when I closed my eyes was what was actually happening right now, and the answer is yes. That I find that, particularly if I'm in a group, as I wish we could be for a meeting for a series of three or four or five times, that it's amazing how much just talking openly with each other and hearing other people's pain speeds up and facilitates the process of dealing with my own, you know. It's really amazing how just getting it out in the open and with some caring people will actually be very healing, and it gradually diminishes. It always surprises me when I fly back to the Middle West to find out that I'm still getting some funny vibes, you know, in my midsection about my parents and all that sort of thing. And I think the fact they died 2,000 miles away, as I was saying earlier today to a small group, was one reason why it's taking as long as it is. You can tell I think I should be over this. you know, these people are supposed to know something about this. They're supposed to be over it faster. Have you heard, ever felt that? You know, and I'm a little embarrassed to talk about it. I'm feeling embarrassment, and I want to own that, about having to talk about it. At the same time, I realize that is not a rational, a rational feeling, but it's a sort of self-image thing, you know, that sometimes gets in my way of being honest about where I'm coming from. Yeah. Well, I'm going to suggest that we work for about the next, let's take about 6 minutes, and or 7 minutes. We have 7 minutes. Would everybody in the room, please, I'd like to have you all experience this. Find two other people that, and take 2 minutes each to simply share whatever you experienced personally while we were doing our interacting up in the group. And at the end of 7 minutes, I'll call time and we'll talk about the whole experience in the whole group. Okay, we'll continue our work up here in the group. While, are the instructions clear? Just turn your chairs around, please, in small triads of three.
Thank you. I love it.
C.S. Lewis had a little book called Grief and Prayer. There's a death, it's not the death of his wife, but it's really a grief and prayer. Well, I really appreciate getting to know you. How about we have a sort of group affirmation here? Doesn't matter either way.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we? Yeah. Right. How many of you experienced some of your own pain, your own loss? While we were working up here in the small circle, may I see your hands, please? Yeah. It looks like probably more than 50% of you actually got in touch with significant material that is in your own life. That's very important learning, by the way. And I think the general principle of what we did here, I really appreciate these five people and what they. I feel like they gave us all a gift in a real way. And I think you may have sensed some of the power of a small group like this to really be an instrument of the healing spirit of Christ in people's lives. And you don't have to talk about it to make it for it to happen. If it's there and happening, then people are healed by it, that sort of thing. Do you have any questions quickly or comments you'd like to make in response to what you experienced? Yes. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else? Yes, sir. Yeah, I think the way Paul went about the group that occurred in Paul's church around his wife's illness and all is one way. Another way is simply to recognize that a loss is a loss is a loss, you know, and that anybody who's had any significant change, like unemployment, there's an epidemic of traumatic responses to unemployment now, where the center of people's work-oriented people's lives have been yanked out by the recession. We ought to have groups in our churches, mixed groups is what I'm recommending, where anybody with any major transition or change or loss in their life is invited to come. And you can do this on all, a minister I know in a suburb of north of Chicago got 38 people together by simply sending out a letter to all the people. He has a fairly large suburban church. He got 38 people together for only 3 or 4 hours, I forget which, and they looked at some scripture that was relevant to this, like, blessed are they that mourn. They They had a brief worship service, and then they simply shared in small groups within that larger group. And the pastor sort of summarized it. They lunched together, and he said that the results were fantastic. I can't think of a better way to spend 4 hours, or I can't think of a better way to spend 30 or 40 minutes than the way we spent it together in this group. Can you? In terms of what actually happens to people. And so I think this is one of the most satisfying. Recruiting is usually a matter for the pastor to take initiative and link people and bring them together initially until a church gets used to the fact that we are a community of care for each other. This is our God-given function. It takes a while to get a group started. And this group, our group here, these six of us went pretty fast because, you know, they were open. The other members of the group were open. But I think groups will move a little more slowly in most situations, but that's okay. It'll take a little longer, but it's a great investment of time. Yes? Yes. Yeah. One of the things that's important in relation to that is that griefs in the recent past often open up old grief wounds that aren't entirely healed. That's one of the principles I think it's good to follow up on. To ask people who are, say, reacting in ways that are very strong to a relative, what seems on the surface like a relatively minor loss, have you ever had this experience before? And often this will lance the wound and let the pus that's in that infected grief wound drain out, you see. So it's a way to... And sometimes this is... I've dealt with grief that has been stored up for like 25 years. And the rule of thumb is that the longer grief work is not done, the more the person will probably need professional help, that is psychotherapeutic help, to lance the wound. That is, the longer people delay it, the greater the psychological cost of not doing their grief work, and the more professional skill are likely to be needed to help them lance the wound. All right. Yes, one more question, then we'll stop. Yeah. Yes. I think that it's very interesting that it's an interesting question, because my experience is that if you're doing a group like this, and this method that Elaine was willing to use here in the group with me it's from an approach to therapy that I think is worth its weight in gold. From Gestalt therapy, it's called the empty chair technique, and I use it all the time in post-divorce counseling and grief work, where you can't express the feelings toward the missing person. Now, the way you know whether the person has let go of the grief is very simple. If you ask the person, how are you feeling, and they say lighter, you know it's worked. You know that they've drained off that bound-up feeling, and that, in fact, that energy that was being wasted by being used to repress that feeling is now freed, you see, to let the person live with it. And the issue of guilt is often involved there. I mean, I think that a lot of people say, well, you know, behind my anger there's some guilt. It's easier to feel angry than to feel guilty for some people. And so you deal with the anger, and sometimes guilt will come out behind that. Guilt feeling is what I'm talking about. Or a legitimate sense of responsibility, which is the difference between neurotic guilt and appropriate guilt. Do you get that difference? To make that distinction is very crucial. It's what Hobart Mauer doesn't make, which I think is the danger in Hobart Mauer's, one of the dangers in his approach, is that it doesn't make the distinction between appropriate guilt. You know, if I intentionally hurt somebody, I should feel guilty, right? But if it's irrational guilt, and a lot of people feel guilty about feelings, like anger or sexual feelings, if it's irrational guilt, then confession won't help, you see, because it's an inappropriate guilt, and you confess till the cows come home, as we say, the person will still be locked in that guilt system, and it's only getting at the inner conflict behind the guilt that'll lance the wound of that kind of infected grief wound. I'd like to thank on your behalf the five of our brothers and sisters who volunteered. Would you like to express your feelings about that? I appreciate that. I had a sense that a lot of you were really involved with us when we were working up here. I felt sort of your presence, and I want to say thank you for that. It was really good to feel a level of group support in terms of what we were doing. I didn't get around to talking about the Symington approach. I think the whole realm of healing, the healing miracles, that the ministry of healing is just opening up in whole new, exciting ways. And if I have time tonight, I may mention a little bit about self-healing using the approach the Symingtons. I think our time has run out, or more than run out now.
Let me just say a couple of things in reference to the evening. The time is 7 o'clock back here again, and as you know, the topic is on marriage in reference to the growth, hope, principles, and how they relate to marriage. The other thing is some of you may be wanting to spend your next couple hours on campus waiting for that time and would like to eat on campus. If I understand correctly, the cafeteria line will close at 5:30. Now, those of you who eat here regularly, am I right? If I got that right, good. And I know you'll be welcome to stop at the cafeteria here and have a dinner. The other thing is, just before we go, as I've looked out on those of you here this afternoon, I see a number of faces that I think are our guests and are on campus because you're here, Howard. And I was delighted to see that there were those faces here that I do not know. And we want you to know that we're pleased that you came to be with us this afternoon, and we welcome you to stay on with us for this evening. And it is a delight, and it is a therapeutic community who is experiencing the grace when we do risk and have opportunity to risk with one another as we did this afternoon. And I've been grateful for that. So hopefully you'll be back with us tonight at 7:00.